among other positive impacts. To learn more or get involved,
and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, Le Chablais.
Is Democracy Now! Immigrant advocates are rallying in New York State Capitol, calling on the Democratic governor and legislative Democratic supermajorities to expand health care coverage for people regardless of their immigration status after passing a bill to protect New Yorkers with medical debt. We'll speak with New York State Assembly member Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, who says the Assembly can make history by passing health coverage for all. Then to the Minnesota miracle, as the state's Democratic supermajority and governor just enacted sweeping progressive reforms on abortion rights, protections for transgender people, driver's licenses for undocumented residents, and gun control. We'll get an update and also look at the Justice Department's new report on how Minneapolis police disproportionately targeted Black and Native American people with excessive and unlawful use of force.
The patterns and practices we observed made what happened to George Floyd possible. As one city leader told us, quote, "These systemic issues didn't just occur on May 25th, 2020. There were instances like that that were being reported by the community long before that."
And as the president's son, Hunter Biden, reaches a deal with federal prosecutors, we speak with The Intercept's Ken Klippenstein about his piece, "What Does the FBI Have on Hunter and Joe Biden?"
In a really extraordinary move, Congress has threatened to hold the FBI director in contempt of Congress unless he produces records alleging corruption by Hunter Biden, President Biden's son, and then Vice President Joe Biden. But what we know about the documents now shows that they reveal things a bit different than how Congress had sought to portray it.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge has struck down Arkansas's first-in-the-nation ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth. Judge James Moody, Jr. ruled the ban to be unconstitutional because it discriminates against transgender people and violates the rights of doctors. In his decision, Moody wrote, quote, "Rather than protecting children or safeguarding medical ethics, the evidence showed the prohibited medical care improves the mental health and well-being of patients, and that by prohibiting it, the state undermined the interests it claims to be advancing," unquote. One of the plaintiffs who sued Arkansas over the ban was a 17-year-old trans student named Dylan Brandt, who responded to the ruling by saying, quote, "Transgender kids across the country are having their own futures threatened by laws like this one, and it's up to all of us to speak out, fight back, and give them hope," unquote. On Tuesday night, Israeli settlers raided 10 Palestinian villages in the occupied West Bank, setting fire to homes and vehicles. The attacks came hours after two Palestinian gunmen shot dead four Israelis and injured four others near a Jewish settlement. The alleged gunmen were later shot dead. The militant group Hamas said the attack was a response to Israel's massive air and ground raid on the Jenin refugee camp on Monday, during which Israel deployed U.S.-made Apache helicopter gunships for the first time in the West Bank in nearly two decades. The death toll from Israel's raid on the refugee camp reached seven today, following the death of a 15-year-old Palestinian girl named Sadil Nakhnia, who was shot by Israeli gunfire. Palestinians living in Jenin said they're now afraid to let their children go outside. This is Hadil Jass, whose husband was shot dead by Israeli forces Monday.
There is no safe place in the camp. At any minute, there could be a raid. We are afraid for our children to go outside. If I want to go to the market, I will be in a hurry to be back home so I can feel safe with my children at home.
In Honduras, at least 41 women were killed Tuesday after an attack by gang members inside a women's prison in the town of Támara. Reports say the women had repeatedly complained about receiving threats from gangs inside the prison but were ignored. Some of the women were burned to death. Others were stabbed and shot. Relatives of the victims are demanding justice.
We want to know who are alive because they're human beings. They are our family. We want to see them and know how they are. If all of the authorities are quiet, what are we doing here? Staying silent as well? No, we want answers.
Honduran President Xiomara Castro, the first female president of Honduras, has fired Honduras' security minister, accusing prison authorities of aiding gang members in the massacre. Federal police in Brazil have revealed a top aide to former right-wing President Jair Bolsonaro had gathered documents outlining plans to stage a possible military coup last year after Bolsonaro was defeated by Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Brazilian police found the planning documents on the phone of Lieutenant Colonel Mauro Cid, who was arrested last month for his role in falsifying Bolsonaro's COVID-19 vaccination records. The Pentagon has announced accounting errors have freed up an additional $6.2 billion to spend on arms for Ukraine. Last month, the Pentagon said it had made a $3 billion accounting error, but officials now say the error is twice as large due to the overestimation of the value of military aid packages. In news from Sudan, heavy fighting has resumed in the capital Khartoum after a 72-hour ceasefire expired. On Tuesday, the Sudanese military accused the Rapid Support Forces of bombing the country's intelligence headquarters. Meanwhile, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, Filippo Grandi, says over 500,000 people have now fled Sudan since fighting began 2 months ago.
Day, right on World Refugee Day, we passed this horrible mark of 500,000 refugees from Sudan. And we know why. The fighting is really generating this huge exodus. And if there is not going to be a sustainable ceasefire and then peace, I don't think that we will see an end to it. People will continue to be displaced inside or go outside. In fact, in addition to the 500,000, there are almost 2 million that have moved inside the country because they have nowhere else to go.
Amnesty International is urging countries across the Americas to stop their racist treatment of Haitian asylum seekers as thousands continue to flee Haiti due to worsening gang violence, extreme poverty, and a deteriorating political crisis. The group denounced the mass deportations, torture, detention, and violence faced by Haitians in the United States, Mexico, the Dominican Republic, Chile, and other nations where Haitians pass through in their search for protection. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi arrived in New York Tuesday to begin a four-day state visit. On Thursday, President Biden will hold a formal state dinner for Modi hours after he addresses a joint session of Congress. The Biden administration is attempting to strengthen ties to India as part of an effort to counter China's growing power in the Indo-Pacific region. Modi is head of the Hindu nationalist BJP party. He was once banned from the United States on charges he did not intervene in a massacre against Muslims in 2002 in the Indian state of Gujarat that he headed. At least three Democratic lawmakers plan to boycott Modi's address to Congress, Representatives Jamie Raskin, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib. In a post on social media, Tlaib wrote, quote, "It's shameful that Modi has been given a platform at our nation's capital. His long history of human rights abuses, anti-democratic actions, targeting Muslims and religious minorities, and censoring journalists is unacceptable," she said. Hunter Biden, the son of the president, has reached a deal with federal prosecutors to plead guilty to two misdemeanor tax charges as part of a deal that allow him to avoid facing prosecution on a separate gun charge. The deal caps a multi-year investigation by the U.S. attorney in Delaware, who is appointed by Donald Trump, but allowed to stay in his role by President Biden. House Republicans have described the deal as a slap on the wrist and a vow to continue to investigate Hunter Biden and his overseas business ventures. A disciplinary hearing has begun in California for attorney John Eastman, who advised Donald Trump on ways to overturn the 2020 election. At the time, Eastman was the dean of the Chapman University Law School in Southern California. Eastman faces 11 disciplinary charges in the State Bar Court of California. The process could lead to his disbarment. The federal judge overseeing Donald Trump's trial for mishandling classified documents has set an initial trial date of August 14th, 1 week before the first Republican presidential debate. U.S. District Court Judge Aileen Cannon set the date on Tuesday, but many legal experts expect the trial will be delayed. Cannon's a Trump-appointed judge who served on the federal bench for less than 3 years. According to the New York Times, she's only overseen four short criminal trials in her time on the bench. In labor news, Senator Bernie Sanders has launched a Senate investigation into the dangerous working conditions at Amazon warehouses. In a letter to Amazon Chief Executive Officer Andy Jassy, Sanders wrote, quote, "Amazon is one of the most valuable companies in the world, worth $1.3 trillion, and its founder, Jeff Bezos, is one of the richest men in the world, worth nearly $150 billion. Amazon should be one of the safest places in America to work, not one of the most dangerous," Sanders said. ProPublica has revealed Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito took an undisclosed luxury fishing vacation with Republican megadonor Paul Singer in 2008 and then later ruled in Singer's favor in several cases. According to ProPublica, the billionaire hedge fund manager gave Alito a free ride on his luxury jet to Alaska for a trip where one participant bragged about drinking $1,000 bottles of wine. Alito never reported the all-expenses-paid trip on disclosure forms. Since the trip, Paul Singer's hedge fund came before the Supreme Court at least 10 times, and Alito never recused himself. ProPublica reports Alito's trip was organized by Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, who's played a key role in pushing the court to the right. Hours prior to the publication of ProPublica's report, Alito published a column in the Wall Street Journal headlined "ProPublica Misleads Its Readers." In the piece, Justice Alito acknowledged taking the trip but denied violating any ethics rules. Heat records continue to be shattered in Texas and Mexico as a massive heat dome remains over the region. In San Angelo, Texas, temperatures reached 114 degrees Fahrenheit Tuesday, breaking the old record by 3 degrees. In Laredo, temperatures hit 115 degrees Monday. According to the organization Climate Central, climate change is making the extreme heat five times as likely to occur in parts of Texas. On this first day of summer, meteorologists are taking part in the sixth annual Show Your Stripes Day to raise awareness about the link between weather and the climate crisis. A massive search effort continues in the Atlantic Ocean after a tourist submersible went missing during a trip to explore the wreck of the Titanic, which sits over 12,000 feet below sea level. Five passengers are on board, including the founder of OceanGate Expeditions, which organized the trip. For years, the company ignored warnings by its own staff and experts that the company's deep water missions could lead to a catastrophe because the submarine did not meet industry standards. Tickets for the mission reported cost $250,000 each. Passengers aboard the ship include two billionaires, Hamish Harding from Britain and Shahzada Dawood from Pakistan, who is on board with his son. And many are questioning the massive media coverage of the Titanic adventurers in light of the lack of attention paid to the thousands of migrants lost at sea as they attempt to reach Europe, fleeing persecution, poverty, and the impacts of the climate crisis in their home countries. This comes as authorities in Greece have recovered three more bodies of men who drowned last week in one of the deadliest migrant shipwrecks in years. The official death toll is 81, but the New York Times reports as many as 700 migrants may have died when their overcrowded ship sank off the coast of Greece. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, we begin today's show here in New York, where the Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul faces pressure to expand health care coverage for people regardless of their immigration status. Democrats hold supermajorities in both chambers of the New York State Legislature, and today is the second of a two-day special session where state assembly members could vote to expand health coverage for thousands of people in a bill called Coverage for All, which would use a surplus of federal funds allowing people who are undocumented to enroll role in New York's essential plan under the Federal Affordable Care Act. Currently, over 250,000 New Yorkers are excluded from Medicaid and the essential plan health care coverage due to their immigration status. The measure is sponsored by New York Assembly member Jessica Gonzalez Rojas, who negotiated with the governor to address cost concerns. But this week, it was not included in a list of legislation to be considered in this final special session by Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, prompting immigrant advocates to rally outside the Assembly as lawmakers returned for their session Tuesday. This comes as Governor Hochul is set to sign a measure that did pass in the Assembly Tuesday and is celebrated by healthcare advocates because it would bar credit reporting agencies from collecting medical debt or including medical debt in a consumer's credit report. A survey by the Community Service Society of New York found more than 40% of New Yorkers have paid a medical bill that may not have owed out of fear of it being sent to collections. Meanwhile, about the same percentage said they'd avoided getting health care they needed because of the cost. For more, we're joined by two guests. In a minute, we'll speak with New York State Assembly member Jessica Gonzalez Rojas. But first, to Elizabeth Benjamin, Vice President of Health Initiatives at the Community Service Society of New York and co-founder of Healthcare for All New York campaign. Elizabeth, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't we start off with this medical debt victory that you've had in both houses of the New York legislature before we move on to the issue of immigrant health care? Talk about the medical debt bill that just passed by the Assembly, was already passed by the Democratic supermajority in the Senate.
Sure. Thank you for having me back on Democracy Now! It's really exciting to be here again. Well, 80 million Americans have medical debt. Medical debt is a severe problem for folks. You already outlined some of the issues, but I just want to point out that there are also profound racial disparities in medical debt. 28% of African-American folks have medical debt versus 22% of white folks and, 22% of Latinx folks, and then 17% of white people have medical debt. So that is a profound problem for people. One of the ways that medical debt is experienced is once you run into medical debt, fairly quickly, healthcare providers and their collection agents report you to the big three credit reporting bureaus. And you might think, well, at least they're not suing, or what's the big deal? But it is a big deal. Credit reports are used for people to apply for jobs, for applying for apartments, for applying for a loan, for applying for a school loan. And so it really has profound ramifications. We were working with a guy that runs a tow truck business in Oneonta County, and he basically, having had to go to a SUNY upstate hospital, he ended up having a big $10,000 bill. It ruined his life. He lost his towing business. He could not get more loans to buy more tow trucks or at least more tow trucks. And his business went under. This is what happens every single day to people by having medical debt reported on your credit report. So we're really excited. Colorado at first, I want to just give a big shout out to the advocates in Colorado. But there's been this movement around the country saying, well, wait a second. Why are we reporting medical debt in the first place? It's not like people are buying a new leather couch and racking up bills beyond their means. People go to get health care mostly out of emergencies or medical necessity. So why are we reporting this in the first place? But not only that, when they started analyzing, when the experts analyzed what's on credit reports, they found that they were rife with errors in the area of medical debt. So, and we all know why, right? The insurance company doesn't bill properly. I mean, the healthcare provider doesn't bill the insurance properly. The code is wrong. The insurance company accidentally rejects it or intentionally rejects it. Who knows? There's this whole back and forth, this dance between, you know, in our really weird patchwork healthcare system. It's not that insurance company's responsibility. It's a different insurance company's responsibility. Who knows? But anyways, the medical debt that is on people's credit reports is more often than not shouldn't be there in the first place. Then on top of it all, study after study has shown that when lenders look at credit reports and they analyze medical debt, that is not predictive of whether someone is a good lending risk or not. So what's the point of having incorrect and non-utility, there are no utility medical debt on a credit report in the first place, which is why, thanks to the Assembly and the Senate, You know, so 740,000 New Yorkers moving forward will no longer have medical debt on their credit reports. And we couldn't be more delighted here in New York. And a big shout out again to our friends in Colorado who did it first. We're second. But we know many other states are considering this same piece of legislation now that the Federal Consumer Financial Protection Bureau said it was okay to pass this on the state level.
Elizabeth, I wanted to ask you about another health-related issue, the issue of Medicaid eligibility. There was a huge increase during the pandemic in the number of people who were able to use Medicaid who had lost their jobs. But now, starting in April, this past April, there's now a mandate to reevaluate eligibility. What's going to be the impact on the Medicaid enrollment as a result of this?
Yeah. So what happened is during the pandemic, the federal government, I believe first under the Trump administration and then in the Biden administration, said, OK, we're not going to force people to prove their life every year in order to maintain Medicaid coverage and also in New York State essential plan coverage. We're going to just say, you know, people's incomes rarely change, fluctuate during the year anyway. We're just going to roll them over. And so that rolling over of everybody's Medicaid eligibility and public coverage eligibility happened for about 3 years. As we all know, COVID is has been declared eliminated or at least over. And so on May 11th, the administration said, OK, we're going to stop requiring states to continue that renewal, automatic renewal. And we're going to require the states over the next 14 months to take a look at their public insurance rolls and sort of slow. And in New York State, for example, we're doing it batch by batch, month by month. We're having everybody come in and renew their coverage. The very sad thing is that some states are not like New York, and they just kind of are just bombing through these renewals and just kind of it seems, it would appear that there is, you know, huge volume in disenrollments. We're lucky, again, in New York, we have a really different approach. It's an all hands on deck approach. We were very lucky that we went to eight funders. My own organization went to eight funders, and we have this great consortium of New York based funders who are giving micro grants through the Community Service Society of New York to over 36 local community based organizations covering nearly every single county of New York, to kind of do boots on the ground outreach, local media buys, to kind of tell people, hey, come in, renew your coverage. Let's try to keep every single person who's eligible on coverage over the next 14 months. And so far, it seems to be going pretty well in New York, but not so well in other states. And I think it just shows the different approach to whether, you know, people really, state officials really value the importance of people having coverage, which we think is so fundamental to people being able to have effective and productive and healthy lives.
Elizabeth, I wanted to play a clip from We the Patients New York, which has spoken to many people struggling with medical debt. This is Anthony Calafura's story.
So slightly over a year ago from now, I was committed to the psych ward after a failed suicide attempt. I was there for 14 days. It genuinely helped me until I received my bill afterwards. But thankfully, I was under my estranged father's insurance. But even then, and currently today, I am over $2,000 in debt. And my mother has refused to help me pay. So I've essentially been forced to kind of figure out this whole situation by myself. And when I was committed, I was 17. So after I got released, when I tried calling like the hospitals, there wasn't much I could do because I was still a minor. And it just felt like a circle, and I never really got like actual advice on what to do. Now that I'm 18, it's been like 6 months since I've been released. So all my debt has been transferred to the debt collection agency. Nobody around me really knows what to do. And this whole situation has just been causing me so much stress. It's like every time I check my mail, every time I receive an 866 call, which now I know is the debt collection agency's number, every time I see a reminder text, I'm just reminded of how much debt I'm in. And it just makes me really anxious, and it's been really not good for my mental health, which is why I'm even in debt in the first place, was to get better. I think there should be a lot of change within the medical system. I think in schools, they should teach you about how insurance works even, how to manage debt. For the most part, I've just felt really alone, even when there are 23 million Americans in debt, which is essentially one in 10 Americans. in general, the U.S. healthcare system, people shouldn't have to go into debt with like little knowledge on what to do after just to get the medical care that they need. People also just shouldn't be afraid and resistant to going to the doctors in fear of the bill that they're going to receive after.
Just before we go to the state assembly member, Elizabeth, the significance of his age on the issue of medical debt.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. You know, if his mother had, you know, disavowed him, he would have been considered an emancipated minor. He would have been eligible for Medicaid or Child Health Plus. That hospital or mental health facility never should have put him into collections. It's, you know, there's all these facilities in New York collect millions of dollars in indigent care pool funds that could have been applied to his case. There's just no good reason for him to have been put into collections. And it's actually heartbreaking. And it's why we have these things like my agency runs called the Consumer Assistance Program that was funded under the Affordable Care Act for the first year and then never funded again, basically over Republican opposition, not to fund these consumer assistance programs that could help people like who was, you know, him, who was completely eligible for coverage at the time. It's just heartbreaking.
I want to bring, in addition to Elizabeth Benjamin, Jessica Gonzalez-Rojas, New York State Assembly member representing the 34th District in Queens. Her op-ed in El Diario Tuesday was headlined, "The Assembly Can Make History by Passing Health Coverage for All." Assembly member, can you start off by talking about the significance of what it would mean? I mean, we're talking about a Democratic supermajority in the Assembly. Already, the Democratic supermajority in the New York State Senate passed this. Why hasn't this bill been brought to the House floor? And talk about exactly what it is.
So, first off, thanks for having me, and thanks for talking about this important topic. As I mentioned in my op-ed, this is an opportunity for us to make history. This is a moment where we have a bill that will direct the Commissioner of Health to submit a federal waiver, the 1332 waiver, that would allow for us to use federal surplus dollars in order to cover a population in our state, our New York State undocumented residents who utilize health care. Currently, we're spending our emergency Medicaid dollars to get their health care. But what this bill would do is allow us to use federal surplus money to allow them to enroll in our New York State health insurance plan called the Essential Plan. This is groundbreaking because we have an opportunity to utilize surplus federal dollars. Washington State got this waiver approved. Colorado got this waiver approved. There is, as you mentioned, no reason why we shouldn't be able to move forward. It passed in the Senate. We are in active conversations with our colleagues in the Assembly. We are in a special session right now. And I'm still optimistic that we can push this through, but we really just have today.
And Assemblywoman, what does Governor Hochul say about this? Why is she opposing it? I understand she claims it's going to cost $2 to $3 billion annually, and your perspective is that it will actually, in the long term, save money to the state. Could you talk about the differences there?
Absolutely, this will not cost the state any money, and in fact, will save the state about $500 million in emergency Medicaid costs that we bear as a state each year for the cost of care for undocumented people. And again, these are folks that are in dire emergency, are ending up in the emergency room. That is not quality health care. We can instead submit this federal waiver to use federal dollars at no cost to the state. And I want to be incredibly clear, no cost to the state, to allow folks to enroll in our New York State Essential Plan. Again, these two states have done it. What we've added to the bill to make sure to guard against any concerns around costs is allow the commissioner to create guardrails. They can cap the program. They could limit it to a certain federal poverty level. They could put a dollar amount. But again, these are the use of federal dollars. We garner a surplus every year through a statute in the Affordable Care Act, and we are pretty much guaranteed about $2 billion of surplus funds every single year. And we've seen that since our program started in 2015, and this would just expand eligibility for those people who are New Yorkers, who are residents of New York and would otherwise qualify except for the immigration status. So this would allow those folks to enroll in health insurance, be much healthier. They're a low-cost community. Our immigrants are actually a very healthy community. So it would actually bring down the cost for everyone to administer the program and perhaps can even garner additional surplus funds.
And you've mentioned these federal surplus funds. What are they exactly, and where are they hiding in the budget?
So they are money that when we created our New York State Essential Plan back in 2015, we had to submit a waiver that said that we would create our own state plan and the federal government will reimburse the state 95% of what they would spend, because right now the ACA requires a federal marketplace. So they, because we created our own state plan, we have this agreement to get reimbursed.